Game 7, baby! We're going to Game 7!
Big Guy Ball Talk, Matt Aikman, Jordan Flegel.
Who is he?
It's kind of like a mixture of Zaza Pachulia and like Bruce Buffer kind of thing going on there.
We're going to Game 7!
Hey, you guys!
Why don't they let more people get on the mic after big wins and just start going crazy? I feel like that would be always, you know, the way to go. Hot mics are, I appreciate them more than most, I think. But especially when you got all that ambition, that piss and vinegar in your system, that's what you want.
Get TJ McCollum TJ McConnell on the mic after one of these games. He'll go crazy.
100%. But yes, we are heading into Game 7, NBA Finals. My goodness, we couldn't have asked for a better finish to the series. I mean, everybody always dreams of this. All the players have probably had a billion shots in their mind where they're taking the shot in the Game 7 NBA Finals to win the game. You know, everything on the line, all the chips in the table. And here we are, actually looking down the barrel. Yeah, the first Game 7 in the NBA Finals since 2016. Obviously, that was an iconic finish to that series with the Cavs and the Warriors. And, you know, we're hoping for the same thing here, Jordan. And it's just so funny, you know, when we start this this series off, the finals, you know, a lot of people were, you know, we're talking about the ratings, we're talking about two small market teams, whether this is a bad finals. And it's like, I really hope all those people who are shitting on this and were complaining that this was the finals matchup that we got are, you know, at least backtracking or, you know, fully, you know, eating some humble pie on this one to understand that they were 100% wrong, and that this has been you know, one of the probably the best NBA finals we've had in, you know, close to a decade.
Yeah, and even if you want to, it's fair if you want to put 2016 up there as you know, the one that everyone points to as a great series. Those games weren't actually that great, like game to game. There was just a lot of blowouts. Like when the series kind of shifted, you know, there's a few Cavs blowouts there. And then earlier on, like you didn't get until that final Game 7, you didn't get these like great finishes in almost any game in that series. Whereas this game, or this series, I should say, you have Game 1, which was obviously incredible. The Pacers come back and stole that one. You had, you know, OKC evening it up in, you know, pretty dominant fashion in Game 2, but it wasn't like some crazy foregone conclusion blowout type thing. It was relatively competitive. And the games in Indiana were relatively competitive too. Obviously, there's a sweet a split there, you know, but each team won a game.
Game 4, that was a big comeback there by the Thunder.
Yeah, yeah. So like these have all been like fun games to watch. Even this one, you know, Game 6, the first sort of real legit blowout with the Pacers up by like 30 at some points in this one. I wasn't mad at it because, you know, it's OKC. It's this juggernaut of a team that could, you know, theoretically at any point, you know, start getting on a run and come back into it. And you know, if they win, they're busting out the champagne versus, you know, this is a great time. The Pacers in front of their home fans to just go and look so dominant, setting up a Game 7 where, like, the storyline is just so fun and intriguing because I actually don't know how it's going to go. People who claim to are the same people who are picking OKC, you know, in a sweep or in five. And it's like, okay, you've kind of lost your credibility now. Not that I, you know, not to toot my own horn. OKC in seven was my official pick going into this. Not very many people had the series going that long. I felt kind of crazy doing it, but I just, you know, I think the Pacers, me included, all of us, just keep making us look like idiots, keep having themselves be underrated, underappreciated, underestimated by pretty much everyone. And that's why I felt going into Game 6 that it just felt like this was destined for a seventh deciding game, because throw everything on paper aside, these two teams looked so evenly matched on the court. Like, everyone's still trying to make excuses for like why the Thunder haven't played up to what their record would sort of suggest versus the Pacers coming in as a four seed on this like Cinderella run. And I'm like, stop all of that. Just look at what's actually happening on the court through these six games and going into Game 6 through the five games. Like, this was pretty even basketball on either side. Like, I think the point differential is like within 5 points now after the big blowout win, you know, in Game 6 here by the Pacers. Like, these are really evenly matched teams. So this whole idea that, oh, the Thunder had figured them out and they were going to go into Indiana and win, like, that I was pretty sure that that wasn't going to happen. Obviously, the Tyrese Halliburton injury was sort of the big question mark there. But yeah, I think on paper, like the Pacers showed that they deserve to force, one more game for all the marbles here. And this has just been, it's been fantastic. And you talk about the ratings, like that even series where the teams aren't quite as sexy, the longer they go, if there's like competitive game sixes and sevens, you're going to draw more and more people in and more sort of the casual watchers who, you know, weren't maybe watching earlier on in the series. So this is the best thing for, if you care about the ratings and the NBA and, you know, that sort of conversation, this is the best thing that could have happened for a series like this. Cause, if you're a sports fan, you got to tune in to game seven. Yes. This is like the only thing on the calendar. And this is going to be a really, really great one, I think.
Yeah. Game seven, Sunday, 8 o'clock, be there or, you're wasting your life. It's going to be a unforgettable night. I mean, hopefully we get a down to the wire finish as well. Yeah. Obviously however it goes, but, obviously I think everybody wants to see like a really dramatic finish, the highest stakes matchup we could possibly get. But yeah, it's crazy. Let's jump into, game six as a whole, recap that one a little bit here. I think there's a lot of places we can kind of touch upon here. But I want to start it off here, Jordan. We've been pushing this before anyone else I've ever mentioned it, all these other podcasts and media outlets, the Pascal Siakam Hall of Fame candidacy, case just continues to blossom. It all started here with the big dogs. Let that be known. You can timestamp it. You can go check it out. We were the first ones to talk about it. 16 points, 13 rebounds, and 32 minutes to go along with the block there. He was able to splash one from outside as well in this one. But, I mean, Siakam was just everywhere. There's a lot of plays he made in this game that don't show up here in the box score. Just everywhere defensively, vocal on the floor as a leader on offense. We'd be remiss to not also mention, the insane poster on Jalen Williams right at the end of the second half. Maybe one of the best dunks ever in the NBA Finals. Like an absolute facial. And then also follows that up with a buzzer beater turnaround fade from the elbow to send it to the half. This was Siakam's game. The odds makers have it right now, and I think most people would agree if the Pacers win the NBA title, Pascal Siakam will be the Finals MVP. And with his elite play, Jordan, on both sides of the court, like it's crazy that I think you said yesterday you were like, it was like watching your ex get married. You were like, yeah, I kind of miss him. I think maybe we made a mistake. Maybe there was something we jumped the gun a little bit on this as Raptors fans. But awesome to see Spicy P doing what he does best and being out there and shining when the stage is at its biggest. So awesome game from him, and a huge reason that the Pacers were able to take this blowout win.
Yeah, he's been so I think for a lot of people, he's been the guy that you pinpoint on the Pacers who play this great sort of, free-flowing style and everyone is involved and they spray the ball around. He's the one guy who consistently can go down and get a mismatch and go and work over top of like a smaller guy. He can get around the bigger guys like Chet. Like, he's just so versatile. And that was always the thing with him, the skill in that size that he brings to the table. And people too, as it was happening, as he was sort of coming to the end of his time in Toronto, and it was like clearly they didn't want to pay him the max. I understood the arguments people were making that, he's not exactly the guy you want as your number one, scorer on a team, your number one sort of best player. I think that all still holds, especially if you look at like through the slog of a whole regular season. If you don't have that many talented guys around him, you can get in a situation where you ask him to do too much. But always going back through that whole Raptors run, if he was sort of in the spot where he needs to be, which is that sort of secondary guy who can step up a little bit, be your leading scorer if you need him to, but kind of falls in line as sort of the second best guy, and then you've got other great pieces around him, he's like one of the most valuable players literally that you could have in the league, because he plays on both ends. His like ceiling for raising his game in the big moments is so it's just there. It's so conducive. Like, he can work in the mid range. He can get to the rim. He can hit threes, which I think he's doing a really, really great job of taking and making this series. Like, he's really a threat out there. for a guy who's like 6'9", 6'10", his ability to fucking dribble the ball. He's got his classic spin cycle moves that he's kind of honed, you know, over the years. Like, he's really such
doesn't turn it over either.
No. Yeah. And that's the thing too. He's always been a good passer, even off the dribble, for a guy that size. Like, he actually is kind of the complete package when you look at what you want, like, a modern scorer to be. It's just been the kind of consistency problems, and the fact that he didn't fucking, like, sure, he doesn't look as smooth sometimes as Paul George or some of these other guys that, you know, people sort of pinpoint as these great cerebral scorers in the league. But Pascal didn't even pick up a basketball until he was like in his late teens. There's sort of this notion that he's not like a real hooper like these other guys sometimes, but he makes up for it in so many other ways when he's in the right role, which he is on this Pacers team. So, you know, you got to continually give them credit for pulling the trigger on that trade and bringing him in and seeing what he could be, within this system. And it's just like the fit is just so perfect. Like, people forget too, I think, or people don't put enough stock in how he performed in his first NBA Finals, which was incredible. He hit the game ceiling shot over Draymond Green with a little crazy swipe through Eurostep, little floater, on the road in a game clinching, situation. Like, he's been there and he had great performances.
32 points in game one as well.
Incredible in the finals. He had great performances all throughout, like, every series that finals run. Everyone knows the stat. It's Jordan and Pippen duos scoring in a playoff run. Right below them is Kawhi and Pascal. So, like, yeah,
I think Jokic and Murray got pretty close to them.
They probably did. They might have fucked that stat up a little bit, but I'm glad he's finally getting that recognition that he deserves. It feels like nationally now that he's the guy. Like, obviously Tyrese is the head of the snake, sort of the best player on the Pacers, but Pascal's the one with the experience coming in kind of with that veteran edge. And now people are giving him, you know, the respect that he deserves. And yeah, I think 100%, if the Pacers are able to pull this off, not only should he be Finals MVP, like, if they're going to win game seven, it's going to have to come, I think, from a big performance from him, because he's the one guy who's been in this sort of pressure cooker environment. I know Caruso, obviously on the Thunder side, is a champion, but he was more of kind of like a bench role player guy on that Lakers team. He didn't have as much responsibility as Pascal did, and he's actually been there before. So we talk about sphincters and how tight guys get in the playoffs in general, but definitely in a Finals game seven, this is going to be a fucking dogfight, slug it out match. That's, I would not be surprised if neither team breaks like 90 points. This is going to be a very, like, I would hammer the under. This is going to be a very low scoring slog. And I wouldn't be surprised if Pascal looks like maybe one of the only guys willing to go and make a move, take shots, and confidently do it. And it's crazy that, to see a guy's career progress to the point where he's at now, but, he's worked hard. We've watched him all through his development, and yeah, he's just been incredible. And, you know, he, like you said, his stats there, that mostly came in the first half. Like, this game was over by the first half when he hit that sort of fader. So, it's not going to look as impressive jumping off the stat sheet, but this was a dominant performance from him.
Yeah, 100%. And before we move on from talking about Siakam, the one thing I do want to put it out there, and again, we're Raptors homers. If you're new to the podcast and you don't know that, you probably figured that out by this point now. But one thing I do want to actually put out there, Jordan, just as something I was interested to ask you, even if they don't win the championship this season, because again, Siakam gets sent over here to Indiana, and immediately they go from that like fringe playoff team to getting to the Eastern Conference Finals. Yep. And even last year, Siakam had some spotty performances here and there, some really big ones, some really bad ones. But especially, obviously, if they win the championship, he's Finals MVP and all that. Like, do you think that people are going to more so look at him as an Indiana Pacer or a Toronto Raptor? Because I still, it's kind of crazy to me when I started to think about it, because I'm in my head, I'm like, oh, no, he'll always be thought of as a Raptor. But it's like, no, I think that might just be the way I'm thinking of it. Because when you're thinking of him as an individual player and his biggest successes, like, when you pinpoint, this current run that he's on right now, compared to like his best years in Toronto, like his best year in Toronto was, all NBA, the bubble year. And then when they got back to the bubble, after he was averaging like 26, 6, and 6, then he gets to the bubble and he was like horrible. You know, obviously he was pandemic P. And then, you know, things kind of were hot and cold there for a couple of years after that. I think that, you know, people will look at it as like, that was his, you know, starting destination. He learned everything. And then he got to the Pacers. And now this is like the Pascal Siakam, you know, like this is his peak. It is really weird to think of that he will possibly not be thought of as a Raptor. Yeah, I'm just saying I think it's a real thing.
Yeah,
he's already locked up to be there for a couple more years.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I can't imagine why they wouldn't re-sign him then past that point too, especially you know, just how well it's all fit and the fact that, you know, the Pacers other outside of him have a pretty young core that. I think they're looking to keep together for as long as possible. But yeah, like if they win the championship here on Sunday, I think that process is already there. Like he's just going to be legendary in Indiana, and he's going to be, I think for a lot of people, he'll be thought of almost immediately more so as a Pacer. Cause already like those last 2 years and even into like that, you could even stretch it out to like three and going back to the bubble, like you said, we're kind of miserable in Toronto for him. And just in general with Nick Nurse and everything that was going on, like it wasn't a great situation. So really, yeah, I'm thinking back to the championship year, which was kind of his breakout year. And then the that's little bit of that next year where he just looked absolutely incredible. So if you're measuring that 1.5 years versus, you know, the two with Indiana, if you can get a championship over there and be an even bigger part of winning it, arguably on the Pacers, then yeah, that might be where you're at. I agree. It's very weird. He'll always be a Raptor to me. And for now it's still solidly there, but, it's crazy how these things happen. Like all these fucking guys, like being a fan of a team and watching these guys get drafted by your organization and then go other places and how they sometimes completely change how people think about them is so insane. Like what, you know, whether it's Fred VanVleet or even Lowry or DeRozan, either of those guys, you know, Norm Powell, fucking, we talked about it. OG Anunoby now on the Knicks. Like it's very, very strange seeing guys go elsewhere and be big parts of other teams. I know that's a kind of universal experience, but it's wild to see him back in the finals. I genuinely would not have really predicted that when that Pacers trade was made. I really wouldn't.
Yeah, yeah. It's they've definitely overcome a lot of expectations here. Yeah. But a couple other guys on the Pacers I want to talk about before we kind of go into what went wrong here for the Thunder. Obviously, there was a lot of question marks around Tyrese Haliburton and his health. He was a game-time decision pretty much 2 hours before tip-off. But then, you know, Carlisle kind of confirmed that he was going to be playing. Haliburton said he was going to play no matter what, which, I mean, is always the comment when they end up playing. And you know, he had the heating pack. He had the maybe it was an ice pack. I'm pretty sure it was a heating pack on that calf all the way, even in the player introductions and the inner lineups. You know, he was still icing it, still holding it there. And then he got up and I was like, there's no limp. He looks totally fine to me. And that calf looked fine. 22 minutes, 14 points, 5 assists, 3 threes, 2 steals as well in this one. Really great performance, classic Haliburton effort out there. Another guy who it's like, when he's on the court, like we talked about, you know, in the last episode, like when he's out there, it is just such a boost to, you know, the atmosphere of this team and the arena, like knowing that he was ready to suit up and play, even if he wasn't, you know, fully at 100%. You know, he was out there, he was hooping, he was playing hard, and, you know, still, I think you could probably nitpick a couple little areas, parts of his game, you know, but at the end of the day, he was, you know, a catalyst for, you know, this run. He was a team high plus 25 on the court in this one. And obviously he had that in like the live, you know, play by play when he passed it to Siakam for that huge poster dunk that we were talking about. He like in the real time, like, oh my God, what a sick pass. But then they like did the replay and he literally just does a chest pass, but then spins after. So I was like, okay, it wasn't actually that cool. It looks cool. It's like who used to do it? It was the no look pass, but it wasn't a no look. It was like they would look right at them and then they'd pass it and then look away. A lot of guys have done it, but it doesn't really count. Like that wasn't like the white chocolate. Like you're literally spinning while you're fucking passing it. But still a cool pass, awesome moment. And, amazing game for a guy, that, you know, we weren't even sure was going to be able to, you know, play any minutes at all. Huge bounce back performance from him. And, a major reason for his team being one game away from the NBA championship.
Yeah, I mean, he's, again, talk about the head of the snake, what drives this whole thing. It's always going to be him. You know, we just discussed how game five went, the fact that he was not able to perform, whether that was a little bit of, you know, that whether that was just the reality or if it was all due to the injury. Like, mm-hmm. this is the other side of the coin. It's like, whether he's got a sore calf or not, he came out, did exactly what he needed to do. You know, no more, no less type of thing. Like he came, was, you know, when I found out he was going to play, it's like, okay, is he going to kind of be a decoy out there? How is he going to be able to move? And he did a little bit of that, but he did enough right early on to sort of demonstrate to the Thunder that no, he's actually going to be a threat. He's going to pull up from three. He hit three threes, in the first half there. Like, and some of them were deep bombs that he kind of took in rhythm. And when he's hitting those, that's when the Pacers look just at their most unstoppable.
Well, that first three he hit, it was like, oh, he got the monkey off his back. Like he hit a field goal. We're good.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But he was also getting to the rim. He had that left-handed sweeping kind of floater in the lane. Like he was doing, I think, just enough to be like, sending that message that no, I have the ability to do what I can normally do out here, injury or not. However I'm feeling, you know, he might've got shot up with a big hit of something before the game, but whatever needed to happen happened. You know, people, again, like there's all the ESPN and all the shows talking about whether Tyrese is a fucking superstar and people looking at his stat sheet and being like, well, 14 points and 5 assists. Is that really that important? But like you said, far and away, team high and plus minus, he does so much out there that doesn't, like, offensively, that doesn't even show up on the stat sheet. Like the way that he is able to move that defense around, you know, just the attention that he draws. He's such a good playmaker and passer, but just knows exactly how to pick his spots. Like, this is like, you talk about like a classic LeBron game that's, you know, 27-7-7 or whatever, like a Haliburton game. And this isn't the best example, but like the best version of a Haliburton game isn't him scoring 25-10. It's more like the, you know, 18-5-7 or something, like something very sort of spread out that does not jump out at you in any particular way. And yet you talk to people who play against him or you talk to his teammates, you watch the game, he's controlling every damn second of the action. It's a, mm-hmm, it's mm-hmm. a very old school point guard type thing, like John Stockton type, you know, Chris Paul at certain points in his career type, sort of stat sheet, sort of demonstrable in that way, where it's like, yeah, it's never going to jump off the page at you, but he's got you exactly where he wants you. He's doing exactly what he's aiming to do out there, and this was a, you know, a little bit of a tampered down version of that in this one, but we just talked about Siakam, who was great. Like, you get enough contributions from all these other guys because, you know, you have Haliburton, you also have TJ McConnell, probably the best backup point guard in the NBA. And I don't even think it's necessarily close at this point with how he's performed.
I was going to say, we've been talking about this fucking guy, like, for like, and I've shouted him out on the podcast every year when we do our sixth man of the year vote. I say TJ McConnell will get no votes, but he deserves to be in this. And then, yeah, when the moments matter the most, like, he looks like a guy that could actually be a starting point guard. Like, I know people would say, oh yeah, he's the best bench point guard in the league. Like, then why, like he's 33. It's past the point that we can give him this chance. But like, dead ass, like when he's on the court, like, you know, he's playing against Shea. And it's like, if you were watching this fucking game, this is the only NBA game you watch all year, you would think that little white dude was the MVP of the league. Yes. Like 12, 9, and 6 in 24 minutes, like does whatever he wants. Like genuinely, like, I know that, you know, maybe if there was like he was like the
four
top
steals,
point guard on a team.
Four,
yeah,
motherfucking steals.
Like, if he was the starting point guard on a team, was like a head of a snake type of deal, I'm sure teams would find ways to neutralize him a little bit. But he is just a weird guy to game plan for because he does things so, like, unusually for the modern day NBA. Like, he's short, but he doesn't shoot threes. He just outworks you the whole time. Like, it's so hard to pinpoint how you could really neutralize him because he doesn't really do anything that is like isolated. It's just very much in the rhythm of the game. And I like, honestly, like, is it like crazy to say that like he could have almost like a Jalen Brunson type of season if you put him in a team? Like, honestly, is this a crazy conversation to have?
Well, I think this was literally like a tweet going around of someone like, what would that look like if you just gave him his team, just cranked up the usage? I would want to know. So, you know, maybe there's some fucking person out there with a front office with a lot of money that's like, look, let's go after this guy and try it out.
I'll just get on 2K and simulate a season, tell you what happens.
You should. But like, yeah, it's just, it's crazy that, you know, we talk about how teams dominate in the different ways that they do. OKC is dominant because you look down their lineup on the defensive end and it's like, okay, I've got to deal with Lu Dort, and then I've got to deal with Cason Wallace, and then I've got to deal with Alex Caruso and Jalen Williams, all the guys down the line. Indiana's like, the domination on the offensive end is actually pretty insane, because you look at like who they've got controlling the pace, and then who they've got out there to hit shots and do everything you need to sort of make an offense run. You're dealing with Tyrese Halliburton, one of the best sort of leaders, you know, of a team in the NBA. The fact that McConnell comes in and runs your offense when he's not there. And then the other guys like Obi Toppin, my God, like talk about guys making themselves money. Like this whole series, he led the Pacers in scoring this game. He had 20 off the bench. And this isn't the first time where it's like, oh, he gave them sort of the boost that they needed to win the game. Like, yeah, he looks fearless, taking above the break threes. Like the fact that he's added that to his game, like it's just, it's insane. You've got Shepherd and Mathurin too, these great sort of jitterbug wing players who can come in and give you just enough. And then between Bradley and Bryant, you've got big bodies coming off the bench to play center. This is just, the construction of this team is just so, so satisfying. Like it awesome. Everything fits together like an absolutely perfect puzzle piece. I always rave about the starting five, but the bench is kind of in a very similar way. Just everything is just plug and play. And then you've got Rick Carlisle, who knows how to work off those dynamics. Like it's just, it's the offensive, you know, defensively too, that I'm going to rave about their offense, you know, more often than their defense, because the Pacers, that's their strength. But specifically in game six, they shut OKC down. Like OKC's offense looked absolutely shit. And people are blaming OKC for sort of not stepping up to the moment and maybe being in their heads a little bit, because, you know, they win this and then they're champions. Like that's kind of something that's in the back of your mind a little bit, I'm sure. But Indiana's defense, when they've needed to lock down in this series, has been elite level shit, and they don't get enough credit for that, and I don't think they ever will, because that's really not their MO. But my God, like I thought Miles Turner for a 3 points and four rebound game, where offensively he wasn't great, was really, really solid defensively, like a huge important part of what sort of anchored their back line. You know, he I think he blocked Chet on a three, or someone he blocked big 3 point attempt, like and he's just, I think he's, again, I've had my sort of bones to pick with him on the offensive side of things. He's had a pretty dreadful series. You know,
can't rebound the ball even though he's almost 7 feet.
Yeah, rebounding also inconsistent. But as a defender, as a protector of the rim, he's been really solid and was really good in this one. And the guy though, I'm honestly most excited to talk about, and this is going to lead into a separate rant, Matt. I'm just warning you.
Nice.
You're going to like it though. Andrew Nembhard is like becoming one of just my favorite players, just flat out in all of the NBA. Like he's also just so weird. Like who the fuck do you even compare him to? I'm trying to think of like a comp. The fact that he's like a combo guard. I'm like, Kirk Heinrich was kind of like this back in the day.
I like that comp. Yeah, that's nice.
He was like a little bit of a combo. Like he could play point, but he was happy to play shooting guard. And he was on that Chicago team when, you know, early on in Derrick Rose's career.
Yep.
Feisty defensively. Like he was going to go. And, you know, I think he's the one who like almost got Rajon Rondo to swing on him in that one series, you know, Bulls Celtics back. I don't know if that was 09 or 10 or whenever that was, but he's one of the few guys where I'm like, I can compare Nembhard to it, because the way that he's able to keep Shea in check is actually one of the most impressive things that I've seen all year. He's able to stick to him like glue, but like never foul him seemingly. Like he always just knows if he's going to rip through, he gets his arm out right in time.
Yep.
He knows how to pull the chair a little bit, or like work off of, you know, Shea's body when he's backing him down. Like the defense he's played on him has been so crucial to what Indiana does. And then he's the one when they got down really early in this game, 10-2, when OKC went up and it looked like, uh-oh, maybe things could get out of hand here a little bit, you know, quickly. He hits two threes, one in the corner, nothing but net, and then a sidestep to sort of bring them back in. And then as soon as he hits the threes, he goes right up, right, and pressures absolutely full court, the full 94 feet, you know, Shea, whoever's bringing the ball up. Like, he's just... He's such a interesting, weird player. I just love it. And going back to last year, the amount of big shots he hit, that big one he bobbled against the Knicks on the left wing, like he hit that three-pointer. Like there's so many different.
I mean, that the game one this year.
Game, yeah,
that step back on SGA.
Exactly. And he, when he gets to the mid range, it feels like, you know, if he can get enough separation, it's like almost like that Chris Paul right elbow, you know, jump shot where it feels like if he gets it off, he's not going to miss it. Like you're surprised if it doesn't go in, like the fact that he's Canadian and I'm going to get to watch him, you know, down the line on the national team, is just, it's such a fucking treat. And that's my little rant, Matt. I'll try and keep this quick.
Nice. No, I love it. Good shout outs there for the Canuck Nembhard. Again, yeah, 17 points and 4 assists in this one. Team high 31 minutes in the game. But yeah, it obviously the offense isn't always there from a scoring standpoint, yeah. But that's, again, not really his primary role. I think it is funny that he really is kind of like the Shea stopper a little bit. Obviously, SGA has been insane. He's averaging 30 points per game still in the NBA Finals. He's amazing. But you get a guy who's been playing against him since they were 9, 10, 11 years old. If there's anyone out there that knows how to guard him, other than Nikhil Alexander-Walker, who also did a solid job in the Western Conference Finals, not quite as good. But Nembhard is right up there. And I like the Kirk-Heinrich comparison because it is – tough though to find a guy who actually has legitimate guard skills that can move the ball and play well offensively, you know, shoot the rock a little bit, but is still that irritant, the Vernon Maxwells, the Patrick Beverleys of the world, Tony Allen, even guys who really get under your skin and are not afraid as a guard and can just stay pressed into your jersey, like you said, for the entire length of the court. But then still on the other side, you're not just a zero that they can leave open. He will hit big shots. He wants to, you know, be there with the ball in his hands. It's a very unique player. I'm sure you're aware, but we've got another Nembhard coming in to the NBA this season. His brother, who was leading the NCAA in assists per game for the last two seasons, Ryan. So we might be seeing another Nembhard out there. And I mean, I don't really know exactly where he's going to be drafted. I wouldn't be surprised. Second round pick to the Pacers. I could see them acquiring him. It would be pretty wild. Not that they need more guards, but they might get the family discount in there. Help him out a little bit. He was sensational. 100% agree with everything you said. You touched on Obi Toppin there a little bit before we talked about the Pacers or the Thunder there. I do want to say it's crazy that now you've seen the success with Aaron Gordon in the in Denver, this really athletic, versatile four that can kind of play against five, still fast and athletic enough to play the three when they need to, can stretch the floor, is arguably one of your best defenders on the team, rises above the rim, is truly a Swiss Army knife plug and play guy. This is going to now be, I feel this is the emergence, having the second player that kind of follows this blueprint, and they are going to be super rare. This is kind of, in my eyes, the new unicorn a little bit. This is going to be the new sought after guy. For the last 10 years, it's been the 7-footer that blocks shots, but can also shoot the three. I think now it's going to be the do it all power forward that can kind of, do whatever you want off the bench, starting, it doesn't matter. I think Obi Toppin is going to be due for a huge bag when his contract comes up. I think a lot of teams would pay him to be a starter. The Knicks definitely have to be kicking themselves for giving up on him so early.
Not even that. Especially, the Raptors couldn't have got him in the Pascal trade, couldn't have said, hey, maybe throw him in for fuck's sakes. Instead, we got basically nothing.
Yeah, it's rough. It's a rough time out there. But yeah, it's
a Pistons fan, it's fine.
Yes, it's true. Yeah, good times over there in D-Town. But yeah, the Pacers, can't say enough good things about them through Game 6. We'll see if they can carry that momentum into Game 7. That's going to be a rockin' barn there, in OKC. But let's talk about a little bit of the Thunder in this one. Obviously, didn't get the result that they wanted. Clearly not. It was over by pretty much the halfway point of the second quarter. And I was still watching, I was following and waiting, and the Thunder, you never know, they kind of, at times, SGA had a couple threes, he had an and one, it looked like maybe they were going to chip away at this lead and get their way back into there. But again, kind of similar to game three, when they really just kind of dropped the ball, and it was what is going on? It was the same shit that cost them the game. 8 3-pointers in this one, 8 for 30 total. It was a horrible shooting performance from them. Early on in the game, I do agree. I think that the Pacers' defense doesn't get enough credit, for their abilities and what they did in this one. But overall, I do think that you can say that there were some jitters. There was definitely some butthole clenching going on for the Thunder, especially what the hell was going on with all these offensive rebounds? It wasn't even really offensive rebounds that they were letting up. They got boarded on 11 offensive rebounds in the game allowed to the Pacers, which is way above the average.
Yep.
But like there was multiple occasions where they were going to get the board on in their end of the court, and then they just let it bobble off their fingertips and go out of bounds. Like, I swear to God, in that first quarter, it was like the first six possessions, the Pacers got at least a second opportunity at the rim. So that was odd. The assist numbers were also way down in this one. Like, it just was exactly the things that went wrong in game three, went wrong again. And I know he had the 40-point performance in game six, but we've kind of talked about this. Like, yes, Jalen Williams has amazing upside, but he's still super young. He's still honestly like somewhat raw in some aspects, like, you know, from a game-to-game perspective. He was negative 40 in this game, Jordan. like negative 40. That's just almost unheard of to be like that bad. Like, and obviously there's a lot of stuff that's going to be out of his control. He can't be everywhere on the court. It doesn't all come on top of him. But I mean, a negative 40 point game, obviously when you were on the court, things were not going well for your team. I mean, Caruso was a negative 33. Lou Dort was a negative 28. Like the whole like top six was in negative double digits for the Thunder. Like it was a rough showing, but at least, you know, he chipped in 16 points. Like he had a couple nice buckets there in the beginning, but like it's just not enough consistency. There's not enough firepower at times. Like Caruso, when he's on, is like this insane, amazing, like luxury role player. But when he's kind of off, like he's had quite a few turnovers this series. Like TJ McConnell, I think, is outwhiting him a little bit this year. Like he's ripped him on inbound plays now, like three times in this series. Happened again on this one. I believe it was actually was it Chet? Maybe it was Hardenstein. It was one of them was trying to pass it out to Caruso. It was just like the like this stupid little like lobbing it up into the air, like across the timeline. Like, yeah, of course you're gonna fuck it up there. And TJ McConnell got the steal, and then the Pacers scored off that one. But it was just sloppy. There wasn't really like that sense of urgency I didn't find from them. Like, it didn't seem like there was anyone clapping, like, come on, like let's fucking go. Like, we can be champions. Like, let's not let them push this. We don't want to go back to seven. I think that early on they were like, you know what? Fuck it. Let's throw in the towel. We have this luxury of a one-game insurance. We'll go back and win it at home. And they just kind of didn't care by the time like
dangerous
8 minutes
game.
Eight minutes left in the third quarter. And yeah, I think that is a really, really stupid decision. And before I pass it off to you, man, on my laundry list of, you know, things that I can criticize about this team, we've talked about it every single game of the series, even a little bit in the conference finals. I get it's your second year, dude. But Chet Holmgren actually is shit right now. Like, offensively, he's shit. Defensively, he's been okay. But, dude, 2-for-9 shooting, 0-for-3 from three. Like, he just can't fucking buy a bucket right now. And I know it's a lot to put on a guy in his second year, you know, in the NBA. But, like, it's just that's the situation we're in. We've talked about this before. Like, we can't just excuse. Like, you've gotten all the way here. You won 68 games in the regular season. You're in the NBA Finals. You are in this position. You were given this role. I'm going
to
hold you.
And you get to play the Pacers. You're not playing the Celtics or even the Cavs. Mm-hmm. You're playing Indiana.
And it's a team that he should be like feasting on in all seriousness. Yes. Like Miles Turner isn't playing all that great either, especially offensively. And, you know, part of that is, you know, due to Chet and Hartenstein. But neither of their bigs have done like really anything. Like, neither of them had a statement making game. I said game five like was one of his best games because he's like actually controlled the paint and he held it down, but his offense was still dookie. Like, I haven't seen him really go out there and, you know, take a stand. I don't really know if he has that bag anymore. Like, he hasn't really developed it. I think he's kind of almost fallen into that comfortability of, oh, well, I've got Shea. He's going to do everything offensively. I'll get open threes and dunks, and I'm cool with that. And I think that is kind of where we're at, where it's like, when Jalen Williams is, you know, not really in his bag and, you know, SGA is getting pressed by all these defenders over there on the Pacers, then you're relying on Chet, who, is kind of checked out, and Lou Dort, who, if he's not shooting a three, has literally no offensive ability at all. Something that, you know, I've only talked about on this podcast for like 3 years that it's just, you may as well upgrade there with, you know, the amount of draft capital they've had and so many good wings that they could have gotten to improve their offense. But yeah, I'm, I'm really unimpressed with Chet, especially, but across the board, the Thunder, you know, SGA down, was a fucking pitiful performance. And I really do think they rolled over in this one and just said, you know what, we'll get them next time. And yeah, like you said, very, very dangerous game to play. And yeah, could come back to bite them in the ass severely, because they just gave this fucking feral, hungry, yes, rabid wolf, you know, a taste of meat and blood in the mouth. They're going to come out swinging, I think, in game seven.
Yeah, that's what's going to make game seven so interesting to me, because it'd be one thing if OKC lost like a close one and it was a hard fought battle. I think they could feel better about themselves going back home, being like, look, we let one slip away, but we're going to go back home. We're going to take care of business in front of our home fans. I'm really nervous, and we're going to get to, you know, our official predictions here at the end, maybe teasing a little bit of where I'm leaning. I'm way more nervous for OKC than I think the general consensus is. I think that attitude is what I'm hearing a lot of people have. It's like, OKC, they're going to go home. They've got the home court advantage. You know, their role players are going to play better. Game sevens are weird. Game sevens never go how you expect. Game sevens are like in the twilight zone. Like, you know, like Draymond Green in the 2016 game seven, what did he have, like 32 and with a triple double and hit a bunch of threes?
Yeah, it was an insane performance.
And Steph at the end couldn't shake Kevin Love. Like, weird things fucking happen. So the fact that they played like that, and it was pretty clear that they sort of played like a team that knew they had an extra game to go back home to. And you could tell that from the first, like, almost from the first quarter. I just think that that is not good. And I was listening to, you know, the ESPN Brian Windhorst after sort of immediate reaction pod. He brings Iman Shumpert on for some reason. He's had him on for every sort of reaction through the finals, which has been cool.
He's got two rings, one with the Cavs, one with Dancing with the Stars.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. He was pretty good on that, right?
Yeah, he was the man.
Yeah. He sort of articulated something that I was trying to say last time about this whole OKC Thunder thing, of where they're just kind of too cool for, they're above all the emotion of it. They just want to go out, do what they do, get their wins. They're a 68 win team. They don't get too high, don't get too low. And Shump was like, I hope someone after the game went into the locker room and threw a water bottle or threw some fucking soup, like J.R. Smith, or did something to sort of rile these guys up. But I don't think they did. I just don't think that that's who they are. And I think they need a little bit more of that, because that's exactly the type of game where you need that. You can't go into a hostile environment in game six against a desperate Pacers team that is going to lay it out all on the line, and then just sort of walk in casually and think you're just going to be able to beat them in a methodical way. Like, you're going to have to dig deep. And SGA, that's my only criticism of the way he carries himself. Like, it's always been a positive all through this year, all through last year, even, like, as soon as sort of the Thunder became this contending team, the way that he doesn't get too high, doesn't get too low, sort of just handles his business in a very like Tim Duncan type of way. Even Tim Duncan, though, you look back when he hit big shots, he would scream every once in a while. He would get the crowd hyped up. I literally I can't think of a single time of SGA really doing that. And I think that's going to be something that in game seven, like, right off the bat, I would like to see him sort of get his guys fired up, like, yell at the bench from the floor, maybe even start drawing to the refs a little bit, like, do whatever you need to do to light a fire under the ass of these guys, because that's especially need. I thought that's been sort of needed this whole series for them, but it's especially needed in game seven. You're going to need that sort of that extra little bit of oomph, which the Pacers have had all series long. Like, Tyrese is going to be like sort of the opposite, you know, of SGA, the sort of leader of the Pacers. He has no qualms with, you know, celebrating even on a minor play, sort of getting the crowd into it, getting his teammates into it. And I think that that's fed into just more energy plays for the Pacers. They've just had more sort of diving on the floor, 50-50 ball type things throughout the entire series. I really think that's something OKC kind of made a mistake on, and that maybe Dagno should have been hammering home sort of the opposite of the 100% message all year of like, oh yeah, we're just going to do this without the emotion. This is the NBA finals. You need emotion. Yeah. You can't do this without emotion.
Well, you're talking about, SGA, and I 100% agree that, we've talked about it in this finals, talked about it in the playoffs as well. He just needs to be a little more vocal, and just show, that fire, that
it's a
fight.
Young team too.
You know what 100%. I mean?
They need guidance.
But I think that is also another, like, very good differentiator for you to point out there. Like, between these two teams and, you know, which one is built to be a champion. And yeah, you look at it like, yeah, it's great that this is one of the youngest teams that's ever made the NBA Finals. They've had all the success. That's all great and everything. Their oldest player is Alex Caruso, and he's 31. And, you know, he is a veteran. He's been to the NBA Finals. He's won it. But again, like, he's not super vocal, it doesn't seem like. He's not out there screaming. Like, he is a good player, and he hustles. He plays hard, but he just doesn't seem like he's that leader of men. And that's not, like, a knock on him. Like, not many players are. Yeah. But then you look on the other side of the court, and you know, we talked to him before we started, you know, recording. James Johnson, who has pretty much not played at all. We said, I went through his whole basketball reference and everything. Like, at his peak, he was fifth and sixth man of the year voting, which we didn't even remember back in 2017. Like, that is his peak as a not even, like, the best bench player ever. Or best bench player of that season, pardon me. Then, you know, you look at this team, but he is, like, well-respected. He's like the godfather. It's like him and Tyrese are the, like, the team captains, and he doesn't play. And this one, he gets in there for the first time in forever, and he gets ejected with a minute and a half into the game just so he can show everybody. He's like, you know what? I'm not just all talk. I'm about all the smoke. I will go out there and manufacture it myself if you're not going to bring it to me. And again, that also, again, it's like he big dogged the Thunder in that situation, because he pushed him. He gave him a little slap in the head over to poor Dylan Jones there. Doesn't even know what the hell is going on. He's just happy he's on the court for the NBA Finals. Nobody gets in James Johnson's face. Nobody causes a fit. Like, if you're on the Thunder and you're in the bench, I know that it's a blowout and everything, but that's actually the time when you want to just be like, you know what, fuck this. I'm going to hard foul somebody. I'm going to do something and just get a lick back. Just let them know that, you know, I'm not just going to take this lying down. And then I think that also, like you said, all comes back down to, though, Mark Dagno. And I think that he's a good coach, but I agree that it's like SGA is a very soft-spoken leader. He is just professional, gets in there, does his business, and gets out. Dagno's the same way. You on the other side have Rick Carlisle, who's running up and down. He's screaming at the refs. He's getting 65. Technicals in he's the NBA senior. Finals. Yeah, the oldest head coach on an NBA Finals team ever. We're talking about that as well. Yeah. It's wild. To see the difference in, like, kind of passion and coaching technique and leadership in that side of things. Because, yeah, I do think it plays a huge part when the you know, emotions are at an all-time high, like they are in a Game 7 NBA Finals. Like, you can't treat it like it's a regular season game. Like, you can try your best. You can say, everybody, let's just play Thunder basketball. It will be fine. You can't. You have to be dialed in.
That's what they always say.
Every play is huge.
This is just another game for us. And it's like, no, it's not.
Yeah.
It is not.
Yeah,
it can't play like it.
Yeah, you can't do it. Because again, once things start to unravel, then you're in that regular season mindset of, well, there's always next time. Then you're not going to be saying it's always next time. You're going to say it's always next year. And we said that so many times on this podcast, especially this series, there is no next time. You can never guarantee on it. You never know what this team is going to look like. You don't ever know what's going to happen. Like, the league is constantly changing. Like, nobody expected the Pacers to be in the NBA Finals. And here they are, one game from the NBA Championship. Like, everything can change. The league can flip on a dime in the modern era. So I really do think that if the Thunder come out and they are still just lackadaisical and they are just chilling and they're just trying to play it like it's no big deal, then yeah, I think they're going to be in for some real trouble and a really scary night at home. And you know, that crowd is always raucous. They're always going, but it's kind of almost weird too that, like, they have such a good fan base that's so loud and so vocal, but then the players just take her, like, chill. Like, if I had a crowd going like that, you'd be like, let's go, like, pumping them up, throwing your arms up, like, just trying to get something, like really maximize that energy you got.
Well, but why do you think Russ was such a legend there for that specific franchise?
Very true.
He would go absolutely wild. Remember that one play against the Lakers, that one series where he stole the ball on, like, I forget if it was, like, Ramon Sessions or Steve Blake or someone like that, and was going down the court. There was nothing between him and the basket. The Laker guy tried to take a take foul, and he threw it up, and it banked in. And then he
just like the spin.
Just went crazy, hyping up the crowd. Like, that crowd energy was completely channeled through him. And, like, even more so than Kevin Durant, he was sort of the perfect representation of that through those whole, you know, even before KD left. But, like, it was solidified after he was sort of the lone guy there, you know, the MVP season and everything. And because
the heart of that team, 100%.
Yeah, yeah, and it's like that's true. That sort of matched that was an energy match, and there is a little bit, like, the odd time Jalen Williams will yell, and you know, sometimes Caruso and Hartenstein will, like, pound their chest a little bit, but it's a very the soft spokenness. Like, at what point does that go out the window? Because you're here, you're at the edge. This is it. This is the final game of your season. And you've let this Pacers team, who most people said that you could probably sweep, you know, if you played up to the to the level that everyone expected, have won three games on you and pushed you mm-hmm. right to the limit. At what point are you going to try something a little bit differently, dig a little bit deeper? I know it sounds kind of surface level maybe, but I really think that's the most important thing for the Pacers at this, or for the Thunder at this point. Like, it's not about X's and O's. It's not about, all this other shit we can talk about actually sort of on the court, how these things play out. It's about sort of summoning that extra little bit that you need in order to sort of galvanize you and the rest of your group to push you over the edge. And, you know, that's always been the way. You look back, through finals of years past, that's another reason why having that like savvy veteran or a few of them, like in that James Johnson role you're talking about, like you go mm-hmm. through it, like those Cavs teams more recently, they had guys like Richard Jefferson who at that point was like a journeyman. When the Warriors won, they had guys like Sean Livingston who'd been in the league for so long, like all these other guys,
David West.
You go back like all the way down the line, like the Spurs teams when Steven Jackson was there. I don't know if they actually won in a year where he was there, but like he played that role. Mike Miller was on that one Heat team, when the Heatles were there. That like you, there's
Raptors had Jeremy Lin,
Jeremy fucking Lin,
Jody Meeks.
I was gonna say Jody Meeks, but you go through like history. Like it's very rare where you don't have someone like that on a team to sort of remind, especially on the younger finals teams, to sort of remind them, even the fucking OG Thunder team that got there in 2012 and lost to the Heat, they had Derek Fisher on that team, like who had been through so much. Like there's these,
what about Big Perk?
Big Perk. There's like this really important role that's filled by vets. And I don't think like Caruso and Hartenstein were sort of supposed to be that. To me, they're not quite at that level of like that much of like a journeyman. Hartenstein's not even.
He hasn't even been there.
But compared to some of these younger guys, you know, he's one of the older ones. And Caruso, like you said, he's their only guy, and he's just not that vocal. He hasn't been around the league quite long enough to really properly fill that role. So I think that's a glaring thing that they're still missing. They're one win away from the chip as well. So you know, I can't criticize them too much, and they've got a game seven here at home. So it might not matter in the end. But I really think that they're going to have to grow up really fast. All of these young guys as a group come together to do this, because this is not going to be the cakewalk that I think people are expecting here, where like, oh, yeah, OKC, through most of these games other than game one, they've been very dominant at home. We expect them to win. I know I picked them to win it, even though I said the series was going seven games. But the way that game six went, I'm really, really, I'm going to reiterate, how nervous I am, for the Thunder here going into game seven.
Well, man, let's dive into it. We've gone over every single game. We actually lived up to our word for once, Jordan. We said we were going to recap every single game of the NBA finals. We've said it before, and we didn't do it this year. 100% we did. And, here we are, man. We're still 2 days ahead. You know, we're kicking things off into the weekend. Hope you guys, have a good one.
First weekend of summer, technically.
Hope everybody also enjoyed their Juneteenth. We got a lot of American listeners out there. Shout out to you guys. I hope you enjoyed it. I wanted that day off. It's like that MLK day. I wish we had it off.
I know. Bullshit. It's bullshit. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, here we are, 2 days away from the biggest game of the NBA season. One of the biggest games we've seen in the NBA in years. Jordan, official pick. Game 7 NBA Finals. Oklahoma City Thunder, Indiana Pacers. Who it's going to be the 2025 world champion. Do you want me to go? We want to pass the buck. What are you thinking, man?
No, I'll go first. I'll shake the podcast.
I mean, you were the guy, man. You are you sticking with your original prediction of Thunder in seven?
Thunder in seven. That would be the easiest thing to do, wouldn't it? Because then, you know, if I'm right, I can parade it around town. I normally do stick with my predictions. Okay, just for the record, I very rarely do I change them. I'm changing it. The Pacers are going to go in to OKC. They're going to win the NBA championship. And this is going to be like the craziest championship of our lifetime, if not the entire history of the NBA.
Dude, yeah.
This is like the biggest underdog. I think I was looking today. They were like 65-1 or something at the beginning of the season to win the title. one of the biggest
has a team has ever won a seed as low as four, the NBA title. I swear the lowest is a three.
Yeah. I don't, that sounds right to me as well. This is very, it would be such a completely unprecedented thing in the, you know, the history of this league. And you know, a lot needed to happen for them to get here. I don't feel great about it. Like, but I also might as well do this.
The 95 Rockets were six.
Oh, six, okay. Me. Okay. Oh, six.
It's still insane. That's crazy. Not, it's still very uncommon.
Yeah, 100%. And I could be made to look like an idiot here for changing a pick that could end up, being right in terms of my, my initial one here. And I understand Thunder are a better team on paper. I'm just going off of vibes and sort of where I think the momentum is. And I'm throwing out, again, I've been saying this for the last at least like three games. I'm throwing out everything of what I thought about both of these teams going into this series. And I'm just going based off of how they've been playing on the court. And 100%. For me, it's dead even. And if you just think about the fact that Tyrese Haliburton looked good, he's got another now three fucking days to get that calf as right as possible. Going into a place where all the pressure is going to be on OKC and their role players to deliver and hit shots. And when those guys are under pressure to hit shots, a lot of times they clang them off the fucking side of the rim, side of the backboard. And the Pacers, like, they're playing with house money, for God's sake. No one thought that they would be here. So for all those reasons, because I'm also like, I'm finding this one harder to predict than game sevens in the past. Like, the most recent one was 2016. It felt like when the Cavs evened it up, at least to me, that they were going to go in there and probably do it, because they had coming back from 3-1, which had never been done. Like, mm-hmm. If you're going there with LeBron and Kyrie and the fact that the Warriors had fucked up so majorly letting them back in the series, it felt like they had the momentum. And then the one before that, the 3 years earlier, also a LeBron team in 2013, which was last game seven,
Ray Allen game six.
Yeah, exactly. It's like they just grabbed all that momentum. The Spurs were about, they had the champagne there on the sidelines, cordoned off. The Heat took it back, and it kind of felt like they're probably going to win game seven too. This one, like,
I don't think that was close either.
No, well, it was close down to the end. Remember, because Duncan missed like a fucking hook shot that just rimmed out, and then it I think the final score wasn't necessarily close, but it was competitive. But also, like, I'm saying that I felt that the Cavs were going to win in that in 2016. That was a really close game as well. So I'm fully expecting this to be a close game.
Which we famously watched play by play on the score app.
On the drive up to the cottage with terrible fucking reception. The where I can sort of guess how the momentum is going coming into this one as best as I can. I just think it's with the Pacers, and it might seem crazy, but I think that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, I like the pick. Respect for zagging from your original decision here. In game six, I stuck to my guns, and I had the Thunder to win in six. I went with them to close it out, and they made a fool of me. They made a fool of me.
Yes, they did.
They, on paper, are the better team. I still think that is the case. And my brain still is saying, what we've seen, what I've downloaded, all this information tells me that the Thunder should win. Yes. But like you said, if we just go off of how these teams have played head to head in this series, everything that's gone down, historical, trends, things that just guys who have watched these exact situations, we watched hours and hours and hours of NBA basketball. Like, we know how the story gets told a lot of the time. And I'm just going with my heart here. And I think, and usually I go with my brain, but I'm going with my heart on this one.
Yes.
I'm agreeing with you. I got Pacers.
The big dogs
in seven.
Got the Pacers, baby.
I just don't, I really don't think, I think that the Warriors, are, or the Warriors, pardon me, the Thunder are shitting their pants right now. I just don't think they have it in them. Like, I feel like the Pacers are going to be hungrier. They are not going to go away, just like they have all year long.
It's going to be a close game. Game sevens are close, I swear, 85% of the time, they are close.
And the Thunder are going to have, they're going to have to fight. They're tooth and nail the entire length of this game. 48 minutes, they have to play 100%. If they even take their foot off the gas for a second, the Pacers will take that opportunity and they will kill them. Yep. And I just feel like, they want it more right now. And I think when you come into a high-stakes game like this with everything on the line, I genuinely think it's a foolish choice to go against that and to say that, this team's the higher seed and they won 68 games, yada, yada, yada. man, a 73 team, where a 73 win team lost in the NBA finals. So anything can happen. We've seen 67 win teams lose in the finals. Like, the regular season doesn't matter anymore. Throw all that, like you said, all
one
that
game.
The one preconceived things. Yeah, throw all that shit out the window. It's down to one game. And yeah, if I had to, you know, put my my life on the line here, I think I would feel more comfortable with this Pacers team. You know, if I go out, I go out happy, backing, you know, Spicy P. It sucks because, yeah, I would. And my, again, part of me is like, yeah, I would like to see SGA, you know, win
The record.
Finals MVP, win a title, win a, and have like a historically amazing season. But it's just, I don't know. Again, I don't know what it is. There's just something like, it's like, telling me, I'm like, he doesn't seem like he's that guy yet. He hasn't got to that final form. I think this is going to be a slap in the face, a reality check. And, you know, maybe this will also be the catalyst that the Thunder will end up going nuclear in the offseason. But again, I'm getting ahead of myself here of what could possibly be happening. We never know what's going to happen in this Game 7 until it happens. But before the tip-off, I'm also rolling with the Pacers to win their first NBA championship.
Crazy.
Insanity that we're in this situation. Let us know who you guys have. Game 7. Put your picks in now. Lock them in. Yep. No backtracking. Let us know. At Big Go Ball Talk. X, Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, Rolly Golds out there. Give us a follow. Help us help you. Help us help you. Help us help you into the offseason and beyond. Jordan, this is the second last episode of the season before we head into you know, our final season recap after the Game 7 concludes. We'll talk to you guys on Monday. It's been a fucking blast. If you guys have been here from the start of the season to the end, if you've ever listened to an episode before, if this is your first episode, we appreciate you guys being around for the long haul.
Shout us out to your friends and rate us as well. Forget. Give us those 5 stars. We love those.
We're doing this on the side. We got our full-time jobs, but you know, we do love this. We do appreciate
Alex's full-time job, producer Alex. The one full-timer
always
on this whole project. We don't pay him, but he loves it.
Yep, the Big Dog Ball Talk Monkey, all of our staff. He's there. You know, shout out to them. But yeah, just give us a follow. Help us out. And you know, the more we get, the more we can give. I genuinely mean it. So until then, this has been Big Dog Ball Talk. Matt, Jordan Flegel. We will talk to you guys after Game 7, talking about the new 2025 NBA champions. And as my good friend Jordan always says,
even if you're in your mid-20s, which I still am, Matt, I don't want to hear it. 28 is still the mid.
No.
Take care of your back. Woke up with a sort of crick in my back, and I've quasi thrown it out. I'm walking around like Terry Fox over here. It's not going well for me.
Yeah, man. That's so funny you say that. Maybe we're like, I'm having like sympathy pains for you or something. Or maybe you're having sympathy pains for me. Maybe that makes more
sense. Yeah, fuck you. Is this you?
I think I threw my back out a little bit yesterday, I think, as well. I was hitting legs and I think on the squat
snapped
rack,
it.
I pulled one of those, you know, the gluteus maximus muscles that kind of goes up a little bit into your lower back.
Yep.
It's hard for me to bend over right now and crouch down and pick stuff up. I'm supposed to be going to the gym tonight. Gonna battle through the adversity, you know, just like the NBA Finals, man. I'm gonna push through it. We all, once you get to your mid-20s and beyond, every day is like your own personal Game 7 when it gets your own body.